Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Look at the screen. William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smart.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself.
Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Min Hunter. This is a podcast about Michael Mann's 1986 adaptation of Thomas Harris's Red Dragon. Manhunter, the podcast, is Min Hunter. It could have been Man with Two N's. Yes, for anyone who's listened to Amanola Dagadas episode, it could have. It really could have. But I think, for better or worse, the minute had to come through. So you're speaking on Min Hunter. Today, I'm talking to a friend who now I've been talking to about Michael Mann and talking on podcasts with him for about 7 years. Has been a great behind-the-scenes mensch, connecting like-minded noir writers, creatives, etc., passing on what we've been doing and just making great connections. He's a great writer himself, doesn't write as much as we would like him to, but every time that he does, we get very excited. He watches more movies than any other human being I know on planet Earth. And truly, for anyone who's played casual movie trivia with me and think that I'm good, this is the man that I would love all the time to get on my team, because I think that he might destroy people because he's kind of a savant. He's a great mind for Michael Mann and a great mind for crime. It's my dear friend, Jedediah Ayres. Jed, hello, my friend. Welcome back to Talking Michael Mann.
Thanks. I don't know if that's all flattery or if it's condemning me to it's a really kind of stark, this is your life, Jedediah Ayres moment.
I don't mean it's this is your it's not the stark one. It's nice. No. Hopefully it's flattering, but I would also say you just like pound for pound, the Letterboxd app was built for someone like Jed, because Jed watches movies like an absolute machine. And you do it in not like a sedentary way. I love your, what do you call your downstairs VHS stationary bike theater?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually got a stationary bike in my office, Jed, on the other side,
nice.
Inspired by you.
I thought
I might get a stationary bike too, because when I'm watching, especially movies I've seen 10,000 times, there's no reason why I should not. Why I should be laying down while I'm watching Lethal Weapon again. I should just be pedaling and doing something productive for at least some of the time anyway. But mate, thank you so much for being a part of the show again. I appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having me. Crazy, crazy crew to be included in. So thank you. It's very nice.
Yeah, it's been an all-star cast, but it's been such a treat. Some of our friends have passed, more of our friends to come in the series. But we've been talking, you obviously have a little, often an inside scoop on what I'm doing next, more so because we're friends and we talk about stuff sometimes before they've been announced and things like that. And I'd been talking about this with our, you know, core friend group for some time, and this is what I wanted to do for the end of the year. And the cake of what we were going to discuss and how the series was going to be chopped up. There were lots of people calling dibs on their on their specific slices of the cake. I'm thinking specifically about our friend Jordan Harper and S.A. Cosby and Jen Johans and Travis Woods, you know, wanting specific scenes and things like that. But I'd love you to tell me a little bit about your relationship with Manhunter, because you're an amazing mind for like crime writing just in general. So I think you're going to have like a huge insight into like Thomas Harris and his impact and influence on the genre, but particularly you're a manhead and you know this era so well. So I'd love to sort of get you to orient that for us as well, just before we jump into what we're talking about. But what's your relationship with Manhunter?
So I saw Manhunter shortly after I moved to St. Louis. Actually, I remember sitting in a friend's apartment and watching it probably late 96, so 10 years after the movie, and clearly, you know, after I'd seen Silence of the Lambs a few times. You know, this was before I understood how much I was a crime guy, and way before I understood I was a Michael Mann guy. You know, I loved Last of the Mohicans. I'd seen it several times. I'd seen Heat in the theater, and that was great. And I'm not sure that I understood who Michael Mann was when I watched Manhunter.
Yes.
I thought of it as in relationship to the movie Silence of the Lambs much more than I, you know, anything else. And I gotta say, I was two impressions from that first viewing. One, I was creeped the fuck out by it, like in ways that I wasn't really Silence of the Lambs. Like, I loved Silence of the Lambs, but I was really troubled by Manhunter. It was horrifying to me.
Yes.
And I also thought it was a little shaky. Like, I was like, yeah, good try. It's no Silence of the Lambs. But part of that, I mean, that's really an indefensible position when I look at it now. But part of it was
Can I give you a defense, which is that,
okay,
Silence of the Lambs is really a genre buster that comes around in cinema every once in a while. And I feel like individual genres have these things. Like, I think of, like, say, once you make The Godfather, and particularly then The Godfather Part 2, it kind of explodes anyone thinking about making a movie that is set in that world without having to directly contend with it. Like, you just kind of, it breaks the genre, and it breaks all the, you know, breaks it out of its conventions, turns it into the pop cultural lexicon. And it literally takes however many, like, you know, whatever it was, 28 years before like Scorsese makes Goodfellas, you know, like, it takes a long time before anyone can even remotely contend with what that is. And then it takes yet another like decade before they tackle The Sopranos, which has got to deal with both Goodfellas and The Godfather in many ways. And I think that just the pure clarity of Silence of the Lambs, just, you know, elevating this, you know, it's making a prestige horror film. I hate that elevated horror bullshit that is somehow invaded and swarming the minds of young cinephiles. It's not elevated horror. It's just really prestige horror with a lot of money behind it, and sort of making the thriller genre, which is basically, like, you know, more serious horror, more grounded horror, with Silence of the Lambs. And I feel like if you saw that in a theater, it's really, it's an undeniable experience. But for me, and I think once you've seen it, it's kind of like, it's that it ruins the other Harris stuff for other people for a time. It's then only when you have the space, and I guess the age of like what your taste is, where I'm like, oh no, this is my one. This is for me. This one is actually for me.
Well, you know, I think you touched on it when you said, you called it a thriller with kind of a more grounded thing.
Yes.
Silence of the Lambs. Well, what makes Michael Mann so special now is that he embraces cringe like like nobody. Like nobody makes Michael Mann movies because they're too scared to. They like,
yes,
he is the most heart on his sleeve. You know, no irony, no there's very little humor, like on the page at least in his films. It, you know, for everything from the music choices to the dialogue to the like, it's all taken very seriously and very like most filmmakers and certainly studios and probably a lot of actors very timid to do the things he does because yeah. They're afraid of coming off cringy, and you know, he's just so sincere that it I was so my first reaction to Manhunter being finding it a little shaky, I think, was me being uncomfortable with some of the, you know, what I found to be, that's a little too earnest for me. That's a little too, I don't think I'm ready to admit that I'm that invested in this. And the other part of it was I was watching it on, you know, I'd rented it from the grocery store on VHS and it yes. was, you know, it was a beat up VHS copy.
Beat up, pan and scan. Looked,
yeah, and you know that editing stuff, there's a lot of kind of yeah. jarring editing in Manhunter, and I think I took it for, you know, mistakes or yeah. amateurish, like they couldn't they were trying to do something and they couldn't quite do it, and you know, now I know that's pretty that's a bad take on on this, but that was honestly, that was my first take. When I became a crime guy, you know, about 5 years after that, I realized that was my life's obsession. You know, it looked different to me. And certainly, you know, several years down the line, when I started to realize how special Michael Mann was, and especially to my, you know, how important he was to kind of forming the way I saw or interacted with crime stuff, especially with crime stuff, and certainly with, you know, issues of like masculinity and things like that, that he's obsessed with, that, you know, I had to contend with a little, then Manhunter just kind of started to really skyrocket, and it still does. And now, you know, especially in the rear view, with things like the Brett Ratner adaptation.
Yuck. You know, can I just say, so, on behalf of all fans of Manhunter, yuck.
Yuck. It's so, again, I saw Red Dragon in the theater. That was what, 2002?
Yeah, you're deep in your crime guy phase.
Deep. Well, I'm just kind of turning the corner. Like, this is definitely what I'm interested in. And I liked it. Okay. You know, I thought it was all right.
We can all be wrong,
but watching them back to back, it's like, oh, what a piece of dog shit. this, you know, it's, I mean, there's things about it. There's moments, there's obviously a lot of talent involved in front of the camera, especially that, like, well, it can't be a complete waste with, you know, like, and I think I can pull out scenes and watch them and appreciate what the, but you know, the authorial voice behind the camera is just not there the way, you know, it is in Manhunter. And Manhunter is such a visual, it's poetry, and you know, and Red Dragon's like a grocery list of, you know, this happens and, you know, and everybody explains the psychology of it in ways that man is much better at, and much and does it visually and does it, you know, intuitively and you know, Red Dragon was afraid of being cringe, I think, and Manhunter embraced it, and it's much more powerful.
I hate to quote myself, but it was actually one of our listeners. Burke made a shirt out of a quote that I said about this movie, where I said there's like 7 or 8 Oscar winners in that movie and it's a bag of shit, and I stand by it. I stand by it. Some of my favorite working actors ever of all time. Some of the best creatives behind the scenes. Ted Talley, Dante Spinotti, you name it.
Yeah.
Harvey Keitel, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Holy.
Well, let's say if Manhunter didn't exist, we wouldn't know what
we're missing.
Shit it is.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, we wouldn't know. You know, and there's frankly a lot of people who don't know Manhunter exists because it's from before they were born, or, you know, it's just not something that was that they've encountered yet. And so for them, they don't understand the vitriol, but God, we know. And it's really not a flattering thing to exist.
Well, we've done enough unflattery. Let's get to the flattery. Folks, if you've been listening to the show, this is the 15th scene, but there's more scenes episodes than there are scenes. So this is the 15th scene that we've broken down. It's 54 minutes and 33 seconds in a theatrical cut. It's after you've just heard Veronica Fitzpatrick and I talk about the walk. You've heard us break down, you know, this guy that's running through this car park, all the police come out and it's just a jogger, and Will is flustered and walking off. Quite a funny little note to end on, which is he's like, what are you all standing there, man, walking in slow motion? Because literally we've been filmed in slow motion. Jed was referring to Michael Mann not having a sense of humor there before, or not as much on the page, but I think that really plays. It's like a fun pressure valve release. But we're at 54 minutes and 33 seconds and we come back to Freddie Lowndes, because we've been anticipating this tooth fairy, this red dragon, this Francis Dolarhyde. We've been waiting to see him for basically an hour of the movie. And in the next 6 or so minutes that Jed and I are going to unpack for you guys, we finally get to meet him. And if you're listening to our opening theme, you've heard some of the dialogue many, many times if you've listened to it. But this is exciting because we get the great Stephen Lang. We get, just the incredible Tom Noonan. And we get one of the most iconic GIFs that is still being used on the internet fairly frequently as well. So we are going to start unpacking it together and talk about it. Jed, you want to say one thing before I start?
I don't know what GIF you're talking about. What is
the flaming wheelchair? The flaming wheelchair coming down the ramp.
What a visual. I understand that. I don't think I've ever seen it though.
I think when you refer to the quality of Brett Ratner's Red Dragon, you can totally just say that it's like, it's a wheelchair on fire. Let's hit this scene. It's a wonderful one. And interrupt away, please.
Will, can you believe that?
Yeah. Gotta love our little cat.
Hey,
Freddie Lowndes.
Yeah, see, there's a little laugh. I mean, it's not. I mean, that may have been improvised. I don't know. And it strikes me that he's wearing the same outfit, the purple and gold. He's dressed like Jack Nicholson would be a couple of years later as Joker in Batman.
He almost is, yes.
Yeah.
And his little straight cutoff tie.
Yeah. He's kind of cute. He's a little more flesh to him than I think of Stephen Lang. Certainly that floppy hairdo and things like that. I think of Stephen Lang mostly as being, you know, very kind of grizzled looking
he's having a late career renaissance, rough, you know, all the way from Public Enemies, Avatar, etc. Like he's kind of, you know, in some of the most ubiquitous pieces of pop culture as this big firstly gruff military guy and then secondly gruff military alien, I guess, blue person. Pandoran, whatever you want to call him. But yeah, usually very grizzled. But I think the hair helps. Just this foppy. Who's the guy? And I always forget his name. He's in Batman and he plays the like skeezy reporter, like Tim Burton's Batman.
Oh, Robert Wool?
Yeah, Robert Wool. He's kind of got the Robert Wool look.
He does.
And it's almost like Tim Burton's like, yeah, I'm going to have like a skeezy journalist. I'm going to make him look like Freddie Lowndes from this movie. It's like, I'm just seeing it now for the first time as we're talking. 54 minutes, 45 seconds as we're looking. And he's going over there. And don't you love this? I had never noticed this before, Jed. Can you see what that number plate says?
I can tell it's a word. I can't see what, or I can tell it's all letters.
Yeah, it says got, G-O-T, chew, C-H-U, got you. That is Freddie Lowndes' phrase when he gets Will Graham. So he's so cringe, as you were just talking about, the cringe. He's so cringe that his number plate is got you. So amazing. Amazing stuff. I'm actually going to screenshot that while we're talking because I don't think people will believe it. Okay. Let's keep going. Next to this little sleek black sports car that Freddie Lowndes just driving is this
van.
A Dodge gray van. And this sensational score. Love this little cut. I think that cut between like 54 minutes, 53 seconds, and then like 52 seconds and 53 is so amazing because you are now over the shoulder, but it's so like claustrophobic. Jed, like he's like something is right there. You feel like the POV of where you're looking is like right behind him, about to happen.
You've seen this before.
Maybe once or twice. Maybe once or twice. Love this shot. And then
I love that. God.
That's 55 minutes exactly. This a claw-like hand tapping with a piece of material. I think chloroform is not used enough in contemporary movies, but it was in all the movies of the 80s and 90s, wasn't it? People soaking up a rag with chloroform, stuffing it over his face, but now just that. This is like Darth Vader lifting up a guy by his throat or something like that. It's like these big black legs, dangling feet.
A little tilt to the camera, you know, is kind of does a lot of heavy lifting. I mean, he's literally lifting a guy by his face, but the slight tilt to the camera there is really just amazing composition.
Slightly little Dutch angle, as they call it, but yeah, like you said, he's literally lifting a guy by his face.
And the chloroform thing is right. You know, people talk about how much we thought we'd have to, our generation, or I'm a little bit older than you, would have to deal with quicksand.
Yes.
Chloroform was really a thing too. Like I remember thinking, all right, what am I going to do if I get a chloroform rag shoved in my face? you know, what's the best, you know, like, okay, if I realize it's hopeless, I should just like huff it and pass out immediately. Or, you know, can I hold my breath and what can I? So, yeah, I spent some time thinking about chloroform defense.
We weren't more, because I'm a little bit younger than you, quicksand was absolutely a reality for us because I grew up in a coastal town. And beaches and stuff, and you would, you know, you go for long bushwalks and things like that, and, you know, international parks and whatnot. And in Australia, we don't have really, or particularly, you know, south coast and southeast coast Australia don't have like instances of like quicksand. We just don't have as much of them. I think that they're a rare occurrence, but we would always talk about that as kids, like, what do you do? And don't move, and grab a stick and throw your belt or throw your bag and try and hook it onto stuff. So it's so funny you just brought it up, like, you just took me back to like walking with my friends through the bush going like, what would you do if quicksand happened? And it's like, yeah. I'll grab a stick. I would do this. I would do that. Don't move. And you just, or you shuffle like this or whatever, just all things that absolutely wouldn't work. But we were pretty intent about them working, but that is a fantastic shot. 55 minutes on the button. Sensational shot in this movie. I think also we're just playing it now. Dollar Hide has got Lowndes kicking. And I think what is so striking about the shot, I'm just going to play it again for Jed and I while we're just talking about it, is it's one thing to lift a person. It's another thing for them to be struggling and flailing and his legs to barely be moving. Yeah. You know, obviously that may be like obviously a trick piece of cinematic trickery there, but that always strikes me in this. And I find that a lot in scenes in Manhunter is like, that scares the daylights out of me that you're like panicked and it's not even, he's not even blinking.
Well, I am frankly in awe of Dollar High right there, because there's no reason to lift him up other than to show off, right? Like, just push him down. Just
yes.
Let him struggle on the ground. Squash but him. No, I'm gonna lift him completely off the ground. He's totally helpless against me, and I owe him awe.
Well, we're about to owe him something. Here we go. That's another phenomena of our youth that is definitely coming back. I think it's because people is on it? Like TikTok and podcasts are hitting smelling salts to like really? Wake them up. Yeah, I've noticed it a lot actually in NRL. So it's rugby league, which is like one of the biggest sports in Australia. Some of the guys will smell smelling salts before they like run out onto the field. Like they'll just like have a whiff of it because it gets them like it like jolts them awake and it adrenalizes them and they just get going. And I've seen a few like silly things on podcasts where people do smelling salts just to watch, you know, people like freak out and have a reaction. So they're coming back. Smelling salts, chloroform's next, quicksand. Please, in one of your next stories, if you can incorporate all of those things, that I think that would be sensational.
That would be. I like this shot though, the golden noose around his neck, know,
the tie texture does absolutely make it look like a noose.
Yeah, it's I don't know, Michael Mann into symbolism or something.
Yeah, or something.
I love that apartment, the poster of the, I guess that's the surface of Mars or something.
Yes.
That's covering the wall. It's so great. And I got to say, I live, you know, not too far from where this is set. This is set in Chesterfield, Missouri, and I live in St. Louis. Chesterfield's like the way, 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 way west suburb area. Like, it's not even in the same county anymore. It's but it's where there's a lot of contempt generally for Chesterfield residents who come in, you know, who come east into the city to work or something like that, and then they go way, way, way out. It's just kind of an area thought of as you know, where incurious white people move to
right.
Okay. But I don't think that's the context that, you know, this is almost 40 years ago. Chesterfield would have been a lot less densely populated. And, you know, I don't think there's anything like the architecture of this amazing house out there right now. This is what Dollar Hyde's house looks like is not what I think of Chesterfield being like at all. And certainly if I went out to Chesterfield and found a house decorated like this with a little, tear away Mars poster that I could crash out from behind some point.
It's really only a one and done though. It's a fantastic, like I look at this moment, 55 minutes, uh-huh. 19 seconds, and you see these beautifully like angular windows that are massive. Yeah. These phenomenal leather chairs with metal trimming, circular, like sort of like beautiful sort of kind of rounded shapes, hardwood floors, and this glorious light up surface of Mars wall divider, and all these great like different bespoke lamps. You've got one with like a more traditional lamp cover, and then you've got one that's more futuristic on the other side, glass, a little TV and a cord. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, this is such, like, if I walked into this house, I would be not creeped out. I would be in awe of the house. I'd be like, I want to live here. This is gorgeous. Whoever has designed this has really beautiful taste. In stark contrast to, you know, what you see in Red Dragon, which we mentioned before, which is basically just the house from Psycho. Like, it's a psychopath's house, you know. But here it's so amazing, and but it is also terrifying, and couldn't be further. Like, it's got like this weird futuristic kind of furniture feel as well as old. I don't know. It's just a beautiful meld of styles. Whoever the production designers and interior designers were specifically on Manhunter, absolutely just incredible. I want to give them a shout out. So the art direction was Jack Blackman and production design was Mel Bourne, and both of those guys really deserve the biggest possible raps. Mel Bourne did The Natural, Manhunter, Thief, Fisher King, and Jack Blackman did Fatal Attraction as well as Manhunter. So yeah, like another great couple of under heralded practitioners who had such an influence on this movie, along with Michael Mann. Have a little drink with a straw. It's all the more perverse. And Jed, you're seeing what's happening with the TV here, right?
I've always wondered if that's supposed, like, who the TV is supposed to be playing for. Is it,
you know, what?
Are they just watching the news here? I can't.
So I don't know what they're watching, but do you, when you were a kid, did you ever like photograph or like have a home camcorder or anything like that, or were at a friend's or family member's house that had a camcorder when they filmed the television?
Filming a television sounds like I didn't have a camera until I had a child. But I used to tape record television. I used to tape record TV shows and
so what I want you to do, because I know you're so familiar with this specific text, Lethal Weapon is another one. When you filmed these old school like tube TVs,
mm-hmm.
because of the way that the projection ran, if you captured it on film or you videotaped it, you're seeing the weird light and frame rate effect. It came out like this.
Who you are.
So it's meant to be coming out steadily, and it's like just like a random sexual TV show or the news.
An animal
comes and flickers and flickers and flickers and flickers.
As purposeful as Dolarhyde is in his presentation of himself, like he's really trying to, he's making some odd decisions, comforting Lowndes with a drink, and
yes,
you know, while he's strapped to this chair and immobilized, but he's very conscious and very set on presentation. This is his whole thing. He's about to reveal himself to someone. And he's going to just kind of get off on them feeling scared and things like that. And, you know, the way he positions himself when he is first seen, you know, with the stupid pantyhose mask and all that. And the, but it, as detail oriented as he is, it strikes me as odd that he'd just have a random TV playing at the same time. And I think
maybe there was a choice there, but I just don't think with classical film, like 35 mil photography, it picks up what the television is doing,
uh-huh.
it's projecting. I think it's actually just a, I think it's a symptom of the kind of film they're using here or whatever production, because that should be playing. But if it's just purposefully flickering and the TV's broken, that's also very Dolarhyde-y. But it just reminded me that there's something that I'm actually going to Google it right now. Why does the TV flicker when filmed?
But you know, I've listened to the first episode, or where you were talking about that, or maybe it was the one with the.
Okay, here it is. Listen to this. If you have ever tried to point your video camera at your TV set or your computer monitor to return the image, you know that it does not work. Instead of a stable image that your eyes see, there is either an incredible flicker or black rolling bar. So basically what's happening is the video shows two different frequencies for the monitor, 70 hertz and 60 hertz. And it's like there's a scanning frequency between a difference or there's between the television and the camera. And sometimes it's a difference in the way that the phosphor dots are perceived to the human eye. So that's the camera's image sensor. So our eye and the camera's image sensor are different. So like there's like bars and things like that. So yeah, that's why the camera is less sensitive to the persistence of the television's glow and the individual phosphor dots when our eyes hit them. So that's why it's doing that. But yeah, I still think you're a great point there about like, I would really, really love to know what was actually showing, because it might augment or change the scene. Whereas I think the flickering kind of just works because Dolaghyde's crazy and he wants to have these mirrors and lights flashing and a kind of audience. So he's manufacturing it in any way that he can.
Yeah, that makes sense that he'd just want the spooky effect of it, because it's clearly it's behind Lowndes. Lowndes can't really see it. You can just see the glimmer. And
I don't want to know who you are.
He sees the glimmer and I don't want to know who you are. He's taped up. He's taped up. His eyes are taped. He's getting a nice straw drink. But let's get to this reveal because it's special.
According to you, I'm a sexual pervert. An animal, you said. You know who I am now.
I love it for how much of this scene, we're at 55 minutes, 41 seconds, that you're not even at his shoulder blades, it feels like.
Yeah.
He's just a giant. So fantastic.
Yes.
Do you feel privileged?
I'm very scared.
That's a great... I want to pause on that, Jed. That's a great exchange. You're a crime writer. You're a fan of crime fiction. You're a noir head. Isn't that a... Do you feel privileged? I'm very scared.
I'm very scared. That's a good... You know, as with Graham and Lecter's interaction, you know, there's this dropping of pretense that happens when you have to talk to someone you're intimidated by, and you understand how outmatched you are, and you know, even someone as, you know, I guess Lowndes isn't exactly a total idiot. He's not a complete doofus. He's dropping that pretense, just like Graham does when he admit, you know, when he's handling Lecter, that I'm completely outmatched here. Honesty's probably best. But yeah, his whole, it's good dialogue. I don't remember what Philip Seymour Hoffman says, but
we can't talk about that. We can't talk about Red Dragon anymore. It's just
I'm sorry.
Awful.
I brought
gonna
it up.
Distracted. We're going to get distracted. Love this.
I love that tape stuck on the side of his face.
Yes, 55 into 58 seconds. It's great. Just a little a flaw.
Listen, as your reporter, your job is to report. That's why you're here.
If you don't, that's stroking him. Ugh, that just little affectionate.
he says, "Open your eyes. Your job is a reporter. You're going to be here to report." And then he flicks the bouffant on his. Open your eyes. Oh God, Jed, that is disgusting. It's disgusting.
When I read the book preparing for this, and I'd never read it before, but the little insight in that I didn't pick up in the film is that that he's treating Lowndes like a pet, like Graham's pet. He's going to just like the Leeds and the other family. He killed the family pet before he killed family, and he's so he's just petting him, just kind of like a little doggy, just running
That's
his hand
great
through
touch,
his hair.
Jed, thank you for reading that. That's a great touch. I'm going to kill the family pet before I kill him.
Yeah.
Oh man. And that little touch, that little tuft, it is like what you pat a dog's head.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not totally malicious. Like there's a little
No, there's
like
a it's
like
delicate.
He can't he can't help himself. He's probably not even thinking. He's just like, I just got to touch him. Just, oh, he's so cute. He's so, he's helpless. And yeah, I
It's the
just
same
got
t
to
in the
run my hand
creepiest
through his
kind of
hair.
it's in the creepiest kind of way. You've got two boys who are now grown up. You would remember when they were younger. I can't sometimes help myself from like Patton Keats' head. You know, when he's just in front of me, just like move his hair out of his forehead. You just like have this kind of paternal, like want to just touch him. He's in front of me. And Dolla Hyde's doing that to a guy who's about to burn alive. Oh my God. Creepy, creepy stuff. Gosh.
Staple your eyelids to your forehead.
So what people might not have heard there, I'm just going to take it back so you can hear the glory of it, which is him telling him to report, open his eyes.
Listen, as your reporter, your job is to report. That's why you're here.
Little
And if you don't
flicker.
open your eyes, I'll staple your eyelids to your forehead.
If you don't open your eyes, I'll staple your eyelids to your forehead.
I wonder if that would work. I wonder if he's done that before. That seems like really hard to do. I
It
mean,
really does because what's the surface area of the eyelid to get the staple on right? You know what I'm saying?
I wonder if he's practiced that with anything before.
Probably two families, which is even grosser because it's like, yeah, this guy has done the most deplorable things to people's bodies in order for them to fulfill his fantasies. So I tend to believe him.
I mean, I believe he'd do something horrible. I just wonder how effective that would be.
I love that you're like an inspector. Like you could be an inspector for silly. Now, Francis, when you said you were gonna staple his eyelids, like how? What's the practicality of that? Can walk me through it just before, just before we move on. You just walk me through what you're thinking. Like, what kind of stapler are you using?
Threats to like you have to be prepared to execute what you say, because once a child knows that you're bluffing, it's all over. So you got to be real
Yes.
careful what you say, and this is just one of those things that I feel like I think he's prepared to do it. It's not an idle threat, but if he's prepared to do it, then that I think means he's probably tried it, and I just wonder how successful that is. It seems like if my eyelids were stapled to my forehead, I don't know that I'd be able to, like, I clearly couldn't close my eyes, but I don't know that I'd be able to see anything, right? I'd be just like, I don't know.
It's a great word picture
I
no
don't know
matter
if it
what.
works.
It's a great word
It
picture no
is.
matter
It's
what.
great. It sounds good.
Here we go.
Oh God, that expression is everything.
Yeah.
That sells it.
Sell
Really sells it.
sells everything, which is he looks and like
Oh.
56 minutes, 15 seconds. I don't know how he does it. God, some actors have such a command of their instrument, which is obviously their face and their body. But man, I feel like he's the I feel like the whites of his eyes are larger, and I feel like his pupils dilate. Like he is, whatever he's doing is just unbelievable to make his eyes do that. It's unbelievable. And a great shot. I love how much of his face is occupying the screen. How amazing would this be to see on a big, big, big screen on beautiful print, Jed?
I don't know. I've never seen it on a big screen, and I
Me
would like
neither.
to.
I would like
I
to
would
very
like to.
much. And as he's pulling back, it's a great little subtle camera move there in the pivot up to his face with the
Well,
mask. And
that's
yeah, it's so
it's so
magnificent.
disturbing. It's
It is
so disturbing.
because of the mobile that's above his head that's spinning. He's obviously got a scarred face, and then it kind of morphs and mutates his face. He's got such an elongated neck. These long fingers, and it's just like,
Even
yeah,
the
the
hair at the
hair tufts
back
out. Yeah.
is it's just kind of a it's a pouty little hairdo. I don't like it one bit. Not one bit. Wouldn't want this person looming over me. And that shirt is an interesting choice. In the book, I think he's wearing a kimono,
And in
which
some of the
is
behind-the-scenes photography, when they were actually going to show the Red Dragon tattoo on his chest, he was wearing a kimono. So I think they toyed with it, but they were just like, it might be a bridge too far. So they kind of like chilled it out. But he's still quite stylish in the movie. Okay. He wears like stylish clothes. It's not just like overalls or like practical stuff.
Yeah. What is the mobile behind him? Do you know what that like?
No, I haven't been able to clock it. It just, for me, it almost looks like some sticking with the space theme. It almost looks like satellites or like a star exploding or something. It's like spinning around. You can see it.
It is.
It's hard to clock.
And if you read, you know, Revelation 12, which is where the red dragon imagery comes from, it is, you know, very much about, there's a lot of astral imagery in there about the stars and the moon and things like that. And so I always assumed it was having to do with, you know, something with that, but just functionally, I feel like I've seen that in maybe disco scenes and in certain movies and things like that, but I really don't know what it is. I mean, it's cool to look at, but I don't know if it had a,
it was got like a purpose. I'm trying to hit play while he's talking just so we can see it moving so we can try and clock what it is.
Yeah.
So interesting. Yeah.
It's a cool little thing. And then that delivery of the here I
oh God.
It's just awful.
It's just awful. It just doesn't look at me.
What Noonan does with his eyes there is great.
Now people are hearing something that they've heard 10,000 times, so we can just probably set it up. But basically what is so magnificent is, again, the projector is out, but not his projector for projecting film, which is such an integral piece of an upcoming scene where Reba comes home with Francis. But this is just like what are these old things called? Are they called a photo carousel? What are they called, Jed?
Like, I think I've heard that before. I never had one.
I had relatives, like family friends who had them. I don't think we had one, but I remember being at people's houses where you do the cascading photography.
I remember being at a family member's house and they'd hang up a sheet and everybody gather around the thing and just look at pictures together. That's a very, you know, 1980s,
very
probably
80s,
1970s
early
90s thing.
80s, early 90s too, man. It was all the way back then, for sure. But so he's playing and we're now looking. What I love here is that we've got this beautiful, again, perfectly sort of composed frame shot where it looks like now, in the strangest of ways, that Freddie is trapped on a seat on the surface of Mars. And this alien being this gigantic Dolarhyde with his morphed head because of the stocking on his head is like an alien that he's visiting. And the shirt with the blue, it's almost like the white are like muscles or like the muscles on the shirt. And like the blue is like weird patches in his skin, holes in his body. And it flicks back and forth to the different family that's happening here. It's so magnificent. But here we go.
Look at the screen.
This feels like, is that what I sound like when I ask you to do a podcast with me, Jed? Look at the screen. Look at the screen.
Do you see?
Do you see? Oh, God. This is my worst nightmare that I've become this man. But anyway, here we go.
William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun.
Can I just say before he finishes that, I love that he hasn't even lined up the projector right. Like, you can see that he's got a screen, but it's like he's so, like, it's all bursting out at the seams at him that he's like, I don't even want it to line up correctly, right? It's so funny. All right, here we go. We might just watch some of this and then we'll come back and talk about it because it's just so magnificent and just as a sequence.
William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
Yes.
Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
Mrs. Jacoby, do you see?
Yes.
The next family as they will look when I go to visit them. Do you see?
Yes.
Mrs. Leeds, later, her husband beside her.
Gross. What,
absolutely awful. And I think what is so crazy is that in our contemporary conception of serial killers and serial killer texts, one of the things that happens is we talk about what trophies they take with them. And for the first time in this movie, we see one of the most disturbing things, which is...
We're clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
After he shows him the Great Red Dragon, William Blake's, we see a photographic still of what we saw at the beginning of the movie, which is Mrs. Leeds. And I remember mentioning it all the way back then in one of the sort of first episodes that I was talking with Stu Coote about how shocked I was that Mrs. Leeds slept through his entrance in a way. But you start to see her roused just as you get the title cards of the movie. But that's we're at 56 minutes, 50 seconds, if you're wondering while we're talking. But then there's this next moment where he says,
"Do you see?"
Yes.
And this one, you then get this shocked Mrs. Jacoby waking up with someone in her room and a light in her face. And you're like, this guy's, we're not even seeing the story or the art that he's creating out of these things, which we don't get to see for the end until the end of the movie. You don't even get to see him look over his trophies because the trophies are him preparing for the next kill. You don't, you know, you see him with Reba watching the next home video. But I just, this moment, these moments are crazy to me. Like that you actually see that he's relishing this, he's taking the time to take a photo, and then he does all the things that he does.
Yeah, that's definitely part of what was just so awful. That first watch, you know, really, really upset me. I couldn't help, you know, thinking about those things. And I think it's interesting, too, that, you know, man's first theatrical feature, Thief, you know, not really, but credited as based on a book called The Home Invaders. You know, there's this very, I'd say this sequence, you know, of breaking into someone's house and what a violation that is. It is, you know, maybe the most potent example of that I've, at least that I had encountered. You know, it was a very early impression in my crime days of just what a thing it is to break into someone's house to, you know, where they should be safe and to get off on that violation.
Yeah. On the fear that you're causing, the sanctity that you're breaking. Right.
Yeah.
Mrs. Jacoby, do you see?
Yes.
The next family as they will look when I go to visit them.
I love that he's chopped a piece of film out of their home video right here. You can see that it's a film frame. He's chopped out the perfect moment.
Do you see?
Yes.
And Lowndes. I love how Lowndes crumbles.
Mrs. Leeds later, her husband beside her.
We don't get grace with the disgusting true art. He's showing Freddy right now. And watch Freddy just take his eyes up.
Mrs. Jacoby, after her changing... The Dragon Rampant.
The Dragon Rampant. And we only are looking at it through this guy's eyes. What an amazing performance from Stephen Lang here. What awfulness he must be witnessing. Ugh. Gross.
Yes, I agree. It's gross.
It's just, yeah, I'm sorry, guys. For a brief moment there, I was just like imagining being in this position and imagining the horrors. And you know that Michael Mann, obviously, they're not orchestrating this other horror, but it's just like we get a glimpse of it a little bit, you know, in the crime scene photography. But there's a difference between picking up crime scene photography and what he is performing. And especially when he says the Dragon Rampant with Mrs. Jacoby, and we see that she wakes up. So there may be more violence that he's orchestrating, and just Stephen Lang's performance having to carry the whole movie and to basically be impacted by the horror that he's seeing, I think is so special. And he does such a magnificent job.
Freddy Lowndes.
He has to look at himself with Will Graham. How happy he is.
The pet.
The pet.
No.
No, what?
No. Not me, please.
Are you a man?
Yes.
Do you imply that I'm queer?
God no.
Yeah.
It's so good. He's in such a panic. They knew that he was going
to
get that.
For me, you are a slug in the sun. You are privy to a great becoming and you recognize nothing.
I love this choice to do this whole thing behind him, not see his face, not, you know, just, and to crop it so that he is, you know, we're in his reality here, that he is on the surface of Mars, that he is, you know, out of this world. He is, you know, we don't see the edges of the photograph. We're just kind of completely within his reality here. And it's a beautiful, beautiful illustration, beautiful choice.
Couldn't have put it better myself. It's magnificent. The power of dialogue and the power of a character to talk and you just to watch his back happens a couple of times in this movie. This is just one of them. But this one is so much more awe-inspiring. No pun. It just is. And I love the what would you call it? Like asymmetrical shapes here. But he is
symmetry. What that is.
Yeah, it's an asymmetrical shape pattern, but it's the symmetry of him and the mountain in the background. It's just take notes, other filmmakers. This is how you make movies. This is how you build characters. This is how you make images that haunt people for decades. It's spectacular. Let's just listen.
Ant in the afterbirth. Is your nature to do one thing correctly? Tremble. But fear is not what you owe me. No, Lowndes. You and the others, you owe me awe. We have one more piece of work to do.
If he takes off the mask, I am dead now. Go.
Yeah, I love that. Do you hear what Freddie says there? 58 minutes, 25, 4 seconds. Folks, he says, if he takes off the mask, I'm dead now. Like it's one last desperate salve that like if he doesn't take off the mask, he might live. But he's so dead. He's so dead.
I agree.
It's just great.
Open your eyes. Open your eyes! You'll read this in a tape recorder. Go.
Don't you love his writing?
It's.
I want to just talk about that. 58 minutes, 44 seconds, really quickly.
It's in the book they talk about how they were able to tell he wrote, you know, his note to Lecter that he wrote it with his left hand, even though he was right-handed. And I don't know if he would do the same thing here, but it definitely looks similar to my handwriting.
If people are reading your notes,
yeah,
they've had a privilege. They've seen wonder and awe and strength of the great Jed Dragon. All right, here we go.
I have had a great privilege. I have seen with wonder and awe the strength of the Red Dragon. All I wrote about him were lies. Will Graham made me write them to pull him into a trap in Washington District of Columbia. Will Graham, you will learn from my own lips how much you have to dread because I was forced to lie.
A horrible, horrible little joke there that I didn't get until, again, just reading the book. You know, because what he does at the end here, he kisses him and clearly bites him. But in the book, it just says he bites his lips off. And the line, you will learn from my own lips
is
how much you have to dread.
I was like, oh, well, that's a
clever thing. I didn't realize, I didn't pick up on until I read the book.
That's so great.
You'll be more merciful to me than to you. You will lie awake in fear of what the Red Dragon will do. I will be a testament to the truth of this.
I love the exhale that blows the paper.
You did very well.
You did very well. Oh, that's encouraging. Thanks, Francis. Yeah. You did very well. Look at that. You read something.
I think this was not the first movie I'd seen Tom Noonan in, but this was, you know, certainly the first time he made just a really big impression on me. And, you know, from all accounts, he's a real sweetheart of a person.
Oh, sweetheart. All you hear about him, sweetheart, super intelligent, soft-spoken, like.
Yeah, but to be that hulking, ominous presence and have that very soft voice and delivery that he does, you know, he uses that to great effect in other performances. But God, it's unnerving in this one.
Yeah, almost scarier that he's so soft. Like you want him to seem loud. You know what I mean? Like you want him to seem like he's got verbosity, but it's just like no, you
did very well.
Yeah, you did so well. You're like, oh, good. This is not creepy at all. It's already the creepiest thing's ever happened to me in my life. And this next moment is.
Will you let me go now? Please.
Poor Freddy's clutching at straws.
He will tell the truth. I promise. Good. We'll seal your promise with.
With what? With what?
with what, Francis? With what? With what, Red Dragon?
We'll see your promise.
Oh, good dog.
With a kiss.
Yeah, see, that doesn't look like Chesterfield to me. That's not how I think of Chesterfield. Though the later shots with Joan Allen outside the house near the river, that does look somewhat like you know, there is the Missouri River's right there going, and the boat in the background of that scene. There's like gambling boats and things like that on that river, so. That does look to me like that area of Missouri, but yeah, I do not think of this cool house and that this location with the trees and the architecture. It's so stylish. Is not how I picture Chesterfield, Missouri.
But while you don't picture it like that, we hear these screams as the camera pivots away. It's a minute, well, 1 hour and 20 seconds into the movie at this stage. And you see the full kind of like layout, outdoor kind of layout. It's a bigger house or it's different views of the house, but there's like different lights. You know, you finally see a satellite dish. You see a flood of white light going in, lighting the trees on one side. And you see a flood of green lights on the other side of the house. It's giving this kind of like ominous, deathly on the left. Green, sort of like spooky, ghostly, racy on the right. And when you're looking at it, you're seeing that like this vacant space is allowed to have the sound. Like he's literally yelling up into the void. There's no one else around. This little house is by itself. And the camera is panning up from the screams of Lowndes having his lips bitten off and does this perfect superimposed like fade out shot from the camera panning up to a beautiful panning left to right on the screen back into the car park of the Tatler.
I love the atmosphere created there with the framing of the house and the lights and things like that. And it reminds me of, and I don't remember who to attribute it to, but you know, something I saw recently on lighting and on things like that with someone saying, where's the light coming from in this shot? You know, where, what's the source supposed to be? And the photographer saying, well, same place as the music, you know, that's where it's coming from.
You know, but I've always thought of it, the green light that we see is on one side of the house. So for me, I feel like Francis's like dark work in that green lit part of the house is like here. I feel like Freddy's getting chewed up, like kind of here, and then the white light is like the other side of the house. But exactly right, like who cares when if I've never been sitting in an audience in a moment like this where there's the screams of a victim are going off into the night. Will Graham's pet, as we would hear from our discussion today, screaming into the void and going like, I wonder where that green light's coming from. Like, if you're thinking that, you might be broken at this point.
That's the whole nerd ass way we watch movies now, is, you know, all the videos about flubs or continuity errors, and you know that it's people afraid of cringe, I guess. It's a terrible way to watch movies, and
yeah, agree.
Five possible answers to the questions I'll be asking. Any member of a team may buzz in an answer, but if incorrect, then the other team will have the opportunity to...
Beautiful pan shot. I love just the aesthetic here. Like you said, just the Tatler, beautiful old like rotary phone, clipboards, notebook, you know, styrofoam coffee cup, like little transistor radio, another radio here, ashtray coming along.
It's
the middle of the night. No one's usually coming down there. It's just sort of subtly doing a crossword.
Everything you need to know about that job, what it entails, is in that shot.
Exactly. It's like, do we need the perfect establishing shot is giving us a shortcut for information so that we don't have to say it. Exactly as you said. It's just perfect. We're just replaying it now. Yeah, just bang. Newspaper, envelope, done. A little bit of sticky tape on the window with some stuff up there. Straight into a crossword or the form guide. We don't know if he's doing a crossword, if he's taking a bet. We'll see. And just comes across. And so we're at 1 hour and 45 seconds. It's been about 20 seconds of just setting up an establishing shot. And we hear something off in the distance, in the deep background. You just hear sort of something metallic. And when it goes, it causes our man here to turn around. Love this shot. Good face. Not enough like working man faces. And then this happens. Oh, must be nothing. Thinks back, turns back. I just love that. In this distance, hearing the roar of flames against wind, and then the light.
The way the flame streaks across this is really, it's like dragon fire spreading across. You know, this is how I picture, the dragon Smaug in the Lord of the Rings. You know, what announces him setting the horizon on fire is just this ball of fire spreading across this screen. Is beautiful. I love that.
Flashes back to him like, what? Like, something in the light is changing.
That's a perfect... I don't know how they... I mean, one of the great things about watching even mid-budget and really low-budget movies, action movies especially, from the 80s and 90s, is how great fire looks. We have nothing like that these days. You know,
they have literally gotten a chair, weighted it accordingly. It's probably got some kind of string or something on the back to orchestrate the shot, put on some kind of body, you know, whether it's, knowing Michael Mann, it might have body parts in it, like of a pig or something like that. and they've draped it in some kind of flame accelerant, whether it's like napalm or petrol or whatever. And they have shot it down here, and it is a living organism as it is burst. Like, we've paused it on like the final second of this scene, which is our poor little guy running away and this thing crashing down. So like, and it crashes into the camera.
Yeah. What a great, great shot, but
let's have one little crash. Look at that.
Just beautiful.
What a magnificent shot. What a magnificent film. Yeah, we've been cheated out of fire. Please continue. We've been cheated out of fire in
we really have. And you know, I think I watch a lot of low budget, bad, you know, stuff people don't want to watch for the most part. I'm one of the people who want to watch these old low budget action movies. And how glorious they look when they blow shit up, or they just set something on fire, or they took the time to light a stuntman on fire. And just what a pleasure that is to see on film that you really don't get, even in, you know, decently budgeted films these days. It's all CGI and it's just not the same thing at all. So yeah, thank you, Michael Mann, for giving us a really great example of the beauty of flame on screen.
This has been sensational talking to you, mate. And yes, I couldn't agree more. Nothing infuriates me more than going back and watching a movie that people have told you is garbage for 100 years, like some action movie from like the early 90s, and you watch it and you're like, it looks better than every Netflix movie ever. And they've spent $1,200 million on that. And like Roger Donaldson's The Getaway still looks better than all of those things. Like they explode a petrol tanker in The Getaway. I watched it a couple of days ago after, as a sort of like a weekend appetizer, if you like. I was nice. Watching it and I was like, look at that truck exploding. Look at the gunshots. Look at the like tight angles up stairways and how they just like destroy the hotel in at the conclusion of the movie. I completely agree with you. And I think it's just, you see true crafts people in these movies execute these things rather than executing it digitally for whatever reason, whether they think it's danger. Like they didn't set a guy on fire to do that chair shot. It was a dummy, but it looks magnificent. You know, like when he lands, all the tactile stuff comes off and you need it for this movie. So
Can I touch on one thing before you close
please,
off
please,
on
please,
me here?
Please.
You know, there's clearly a lot in this movie to talk about, and I'm going to confine it to the scene that I'm working on. But because we did get the shot of Blake's painting, the Red Dragon, and I love how that painting is recreated later in the film as Dolarhyde is looming over the Reba character. I love that. I love all the stuff, all the Blake analogies, you know, the tiger getting his tooth capped and Dolarhyde's, you know, teeth and the tiger poem. And I just think it's beautiful that the name synonymous with Michael Mann fandom these days is Blake. I think that's just a beautiful thing that I'm not going to unpack further, but there you go.
That's nice. I didn't know where you were going with that, but that's nice. I can't top that. That's perfect. Jed Ayers, you're the best. I love you. Thank you so much for doing this. And now I don't know what to think. Tigers being tapped, faces being bitten off, seeing the glory of the Red Dragon, and Blake and Michael Mann inexorably linked.
Like that.
This has been an episode of Minhunter, the latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I, and all modern man movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there. And the Jimmy Kahn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon / One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron for as little as a dollar a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Min Hunter episode, Min Hunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What's your perfect night? Is it curling up on the couch for a cozy, peaceful night in? Therapy can feel a bit like that, your comfort place where you replenish your energy. With BetterHelp, get matched with a therapist based on your needs entirely online. It's convenient and suited to your schedule. Find comfort this season with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.